it lacks the power to perform its basic responsibilities, is simply sabotage. It is a telling fact that power producers, electricity producers in response to market forces, have achieved a shift to cleaner energy that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, sought to require in 2015, validating the agency's assessment of what it could reasonably mandate. Chief Justice John Roberts' predecessors recognized their own limitations. In the 1984 ruling that formalized the court's policy of regulatory deference, Chief Justice John Paul Stevens wrote that the judges are not experts in the field and are not part of either political branch of the government. Both points are important. The court lacks technical expertise and an electoral mandate. Last Thursday's decision asserting a more muscular role is thus a blow to both the public interest and to democracy.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how India has elevated its global stature by pursuing a proactive foreign policy vis-à-vis Russia, refusing to buckle under Western pressure. And we shall also take a look at Narendra Modi-led BJP government's failed experiment in Indian-controlled Kashmir amid the deteriorating security in the region.
In a show of extraordinary defiance to US pressures, India has not only continued but scaled up its oil purchases from Russia since the Ukraine war began 4 months ago. Russian oil now accounts for 10% of India's total crude imports compared to just 0.2% before the war. With Western countries announcing the boycott of Russia's energy market, Indian refiners have taken advantage of the situation, purchasing Russian oil at a discount of $30 per barrel.
India, the third largest oil consumer in the world after China and the US, has relied heavily on Arab countries for 85% of its oil needs. Before Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in February, Iraq and Saudi Arabia were the two biggest suppliers of oil to New Delhi. In June, Moscow edged past Riyadh to become the second biggest supplier of oil to India, wooing Indian refiners with heavily discounted crude. According to industry data, of all crude oil imports from overseas, the share of Russia has surged more than 50 times in the last 3 months.
If you look at other countries, let us say in Europe, France, Britain, Japan, they're all dependent on the US for their security. Okay? India is not dependent on the US for its security. India is certainly likes US political support. But at the end of the day, India depends on itself. So it is self-interest which is driving Indian policy. I don't think any ideology drives it.
India and some other Asian countries have become key sources of oil revenue for Russia at a time when Washington and its NATO allies are attempting to cut Russia's energy market from the world over the Ukraine war. After failing to persuade the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi to cut its energy and defense ties with Russia, US officials have now come to recognize India's need for affordable energy. India's foreign ministry, as well as the Ministry of Petroleum, have repeatedly emphasized the country's need to protect its best interests, disregarding criticism over its imports of Russian oil.
India's firm stance on its time-tested relations with Russia and refusal to condemn Moscow's military operation in Ukraine or to snap its energy and defense ties with Russia is seen as a carefully choreographed move by New Delhi to project itself as a global player. In recent months, Western powers, including the US, vigorously courted India to deny strategic advantage to their chief adversary. The BJP-led government in New Delhi refused to join the circus, elevating India's stature at the global level and securing its burgeoning energy needs.
Many top Western officials made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent months in order to persuade the Indian government to recalibrate its position on Russia's military operation in Ukraine and to cut its dependence on Russian energy. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, however, stood his ground. His refusal to toe the Western line is seen by many as a calculated move to carve a superpower role for the world's second most populated country, pave the way for a multipolar international system, and lobby for India's permanent UN Security Council seat. India hasn't cut its ties with the US, though. The two countries continue to be strategic allies and are part of the Quad group along with Australia and Japan. But New Delhi has chosen to pursue an ultra-realist policy to safeguard its interests, including the overwhelming need for Russia's military equipment and oil. At first, the strategy appeared to antagonize the US when Joe Biden described India's position on Russia as somewhat shaky. But by April, Americans dramatically changed their tune and reluctantly accepted Modi's position. In the last few months, India has proactively pursued its ties with Russia by abstaining from UN resolutions against Russia and ramping up discounted crude imports as well as the purchase of military hardware.
Now, to have more insight on this issue, we are joined by Mr. Mubin Jafar Mir, Research Officer, Center for International Strategic Studies from Islamabad. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Jafar Mir. India's imports of crude oil from Russia have significantly surged since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Now, could you say that this implies assertive foreign policy based on national interests?
Yes, I think it implies assertive foreign policy on part of India, as it is brushing aside the Western intimidation against anyone not opposing Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. I think economic interests are a precursor to formulating any foreign policy decision, and it applies on every state. And given the poor economic condition globally and rising inflation worldwide, every state prefers to follow economic interest, even if it comes on the altar of sacrificing its principles. And India, when we particularly talk about India, it has expansionist and hegemonic designs, and it can do anything to achieve that goal. And India has been successfully able to balance a role between Washington and Moscow because of the US policy of bolstering India as a counterweight to China. As you have asked whether its policy is assertive, I say yes, it's assertive, because if you recall Indian External Affairs Minister Dr. J.S. Shankar's statement earlier this month at Global Sec 2022 Forum, and that his statement was a clear manifestation of India's assertive foreign policy. He said that Europe's problems are the that he actually condemned Europe for criticizing India and said that Europe's problems are the world problems, but the world problems are not Europe's problems, and Europe has to get out of this mindset.
Mr. Jafar Mir, initially the Biden administration used many different tactics to persuade India to cut its energy and defense ties with Russia. So have the Americans now given up?
It's a very important question. Yes, it is true that India has not been listening to the West. But, you know, India is not an exception. There are many countries now in the world that are not accepting the Western rhetoric of isolating Russia. Many West Asian, Arab countries, and even European countries have not liked the idea of completely abandoning Russia and have not only continued but even further strengthened their ties with Russia. And whether you have asked if America has given up, it is difficult to say whether they have given up, but the U.S. lacks options in the foreseeable future. For now, the U.S. strategy, I think, would be to prolong the Ukraine war through pumping more financial and military aid to Ukrainian leadership, Ukrainian military, while simultaneously convincing India that a weak Russia can't help it in its aspiration to become a global power. The U.S. also cannot sever ties with India over Russia because India is a close ally of Israel. I mean, Israel is one of the top destinations of India to import its weapons. So that India-Israel nexus is also paramount to understand the U.S. policies towards India.
Mr. Jaffa Amir, apart from discounted crude oil and military hardware, what makes Russia such an important partner for India, and has it got anything to do with India's strained ties with China?
Yes, it's a very good question. Russia is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council and has been supporting India at various international forums. It has previously stood by India on its Kashmir stance, even at the time when the U.S. wanted to pursue the Kashmir case as per the UN resolutions. Unfortunately, that is no more the case, and the United States has in recent times strengthened its nuclear civil deal in India with severe consequences for strategic balance in the region. It has adversely impacted strategic stability in South Asia. And yes, it has a lot to do with Indo-China rivalry as well. India is fearful of Russia becoming overly dependent on China. India, in fact, is not very welcoming toward the idea of Western sanctions on Moscow. And if we see that Russia and if we talk about their importance of their bilateral ties, Russia looks at India as a hedge against complete Chinese domination in key parts of Eurasia like Central Asia. Moscow desires that India becomes an economic force to be reckoned with in Central Asia and counters expanding Chinese economic influence there.
Mr. Jaffa Amir, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Dmitry Alexander Symes, a journalist focusing on Russia and Asia, notes that India's crude oil imports from Russia have jumped over 50 times since April, while before the Ukraine war, it made up for just 0.2% of India's total oil imports. Senior Indian broadcast journalist Pallavi Ghosh cites a senior government official telling her that India won't buckle under the G7 pressure on Russian oil imports or the Ukraine issue. Surya Kanagankar, a trader and analyst explaining India's decision to continue Russian oil imports, says every country that has leverage tries to use it, adding that the US tried to make 1.4 billion Indians suffer from inflation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Years after the Narendra Modi-led Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status and statehood in a controversial move that was advertised as a panacea for all the problems facing the disputed territory, things have not only not changed but turned worse. During this period, the security situation has deteriorated alarmingly with frequent gun battles and killings of civilians, militancy has surged, anti-India sentiments have deepened, the local economy has been destroyed, and the people have lost their means of livelihood.
On August the 5th, 2019, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party unilaterally scrapped a law that gave special status to Indian-controlled Kashmir amid stringent lockdown and massive military deployment in the contested Himalayan region. The government claimed that the move was aimed at ushering in peace and economic prosperity there. Almost 3 years down the line, peace and stability remain far-fetched dreams, while daily killings of both civilians and armed rebels continue. The facade of normalcy has been shattered. According to Kashmir police, this year alone, more than 100 suspected Kashmiri rebels, most of them youngsters aged between 18 and 26, have been killed by the Indian police and military forces. Since the abrogation of the region's semi-autonomous status 3 years ago, at least 197 security personnel, 675 suspected rebels, and 131 civilians have been killed as per official figures. Among those targeted are members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities and non-migrant workers who have lashed out at the ruling party in New Delhi for pushing the false narrative of normalcy and failing to provide them protection. The worsening security situation has prompted even pro-India figures to question PM Modi's muscular approach in Kashmir.
Revoking Kashmir's special status figured prominently on BJP's election agenda in 2019, which helped Narendra Modi return to power with a massive mandate. The move was designed to appease the majority Hindu community in India at the risk of fueling anti-India sentiments in the contested region. Weeks before announcing the move in August 2019, Kashmir was turned into a fortress, with massive army deployment and the arrest of thousands of political leaders, activists and academics. The muscular approach proved counterproductive as India lost the last vestiges of its goodwill in Kashmir.
The revocation of Kashmir's special status and attempts at altering the Muslim-majority region's demography have come at a great cost for New Delhi. The BJP government's move appears to have alienated both Muslims and Hindus in Kashmir.
The government of India is saying that everything is normal here. Delegations, foreign delegations are coming here to visit, but they are not talking to anybody. Even media is not allowed to present their point of view. Only selected people are getting there and they are meeting them.
While it pushed Kashmiri Muslims further away, including those who swore by the Indian constitution before the events of August 2019, it also compounded the misery of minority groups in Kashmir. They feel more insecure today than at any point in history, despite the BJP government giving them greater representation in a recently released list of redrawn electoral constituencies in Kashmir. The muscular approach adopted by the Hindu nationalist government to suppress the majority Muslim community in the disputed region has proved to be a failed gambit. As per the official 2011 census of the region's total population of 12.5 million, Muslims comprise 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. Even leaders of traditionally pro-India political outfits feel alienated today. Mehbooba Mufti, former chief minister of Kashmir, recently accused the Modi government of pushing young men towards armed resistance. She said the BJP builds its vote bank in the rest of India by suppressing Kashmiris. Even politicians in mainland India have slammed the move, questioning the wisdom behind it.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Sayed Nazir Gilani, President of Jammu and Kashmir Council for Human Rights from London, UK. Now, Dr. Gilani, welcome to the program. Now, 3 years after India's Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, revoked Kashmir's semi-autonomous status, things appear to have gone from bad to worse. Now, do you think it was bound to happen?
Of course it was bound to happen, but it does not matter at all as far as the question of Kashmir is concerned, because it is Indian loss, not the loss of the people of Kashmir, because the temporary or the provisional accession that Kashmiris had with India it was surrendered by the government of India at the UN on 15th of January 1948. So for a UN supervised vote. So until UN would have carried out a vote in Kashmir, the state of Jammu and Kashmir on the Indian side had a very temporary arrangement with the government of India how to conduct the business. So this was the link between Srinagar and Delhi, and they have broken it themselves. So it is a very difficult question, constitutional question, which Kashmiris have taken to the Supreme Court of India as well, but it is a violation of the UN template on Kashmir. It is a violation of Kashmiris' agreement with the New Delhi or Indian agreement with the government of Pakistan or the Indian assurance given to the British government in November 1948. So the Indian thought process that they might be in a position to curtail or to crush the popular resistance in Kashmir has not worked, because it is not something that India can very easily get away with. People have been through difficult times through centuries from 1846. So the connection with India has started in October 1947. So that does not mean that the people of Kashmir have given up on the question of rights, dignity, security, and self-determination. So India has to fail anyway, because it's Indian failure, and the connection between Kashmir and India does not exist at this point. The only connection is that we have a massive deployment of Indian army in the valley.
Dr. Gilani, the BJP government claimed the events of August 2019 would bring peace and prosperity to Kashmir, but we see the security situation has deteriorated and businesses have suffered huge losses. Now, can muscular approach ever work in Kashmir's context?
One of the most senior Indian leaders, Yashwant Sinha, when he visited Kashmir and went back to Delhi before India decided to take the action on 5th of August 2019, he told the Indian public on national television that the only link between India and Kashmir are the coercive forces, our military deployment. Muscular approach has not worked around the world, and it won't work. It didn't work in Afghanistan, it didn't work in Iraq, it doesn't work in Palestine. It didn't work for Indians as well, for the British in India. So I don't think that those who harbor this this delusion that one day the Kashmiris might get exhausted or they might be without friends. We have a UN template on Kashmir. And for that, we have the assurance of 193 countries of the world. So we, rather the people of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, are not the only people who live on the Indian side. There is another administration which is on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, and the third administration is Gilgit and Baltistan. So it would be very difficult for India to round up all these three administrations and then to put them under the military feet. It's very difficult. Indian civil society, the common man in India, is feeling guilty and remorseful that they have been very unkind, very deceitful, and very aggressive and inhumane in Kashmir. So we see in Kashmir a different India. The world knows India in one form, but we have known India in different form, where we have the orphans, we have the widows, we have the half widows, and we have the victims of Piran Pushpura gang rape, and a whole list of human rights violations stand against the state of India. So it would be very difficult for them to live up in the form that they have decided to live on the Indian side of Kashmir, because they cannot overpower the people living on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, Gilgit-Baltistan, and 2.5 million Kashmiri Muslim refugees living in the four provinces of Pakistan, and a very huge, very aggressive, very refined and robust Kashmiri diaspora is there. So India has many fronts to stand up to. I don't think they will be that, their spread is that broad that they will vanquish us on all fronts.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Gilani for his precious time and knowledge. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based journalist Akash Hassan shares a video of Indian police locking gates of a residential locality and stopping Kashmiri Hindu protesters who demand relocation following recent killings. Samar Halarankar, a New Delhi-based editor, quotes a Kashmiri Hindu saying that insecurity and killings of minorities rose after the revocation of Kashmir's special status by the Modi government. A Melbourne-based anti-Islamophobia activist, Sania Wajahat, asks why Indian Muslim activists who are speaking up now against the Modi government didn't break their silence when human rights violations were taking place in Kashmir.
And that was our episode about the growing ties between New Delhi and Moscow despite Western pressures and the Indian government's failed policy in Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating is lower than Donald Trump's was at the same stage of his presidency, as the Democrats are bracing for potential major losses in this year's midterm elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Joe Biden's approval rating worse than Trump's at this stage of presidency. U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating is lower than Donald Trump's was at the same stage of his presidency, as the Democrats are bracing for potential major losses in this year's midterm elections. President Biden's approval rating was 39% as of 30th of June, according to analysis by poll tracker 538, while 56.2% of the American public disapproved of the way that Joe Biden is handling his job as president. Donald Trump's approval rating on 1st of July 2018 was 41.8%, while 52.3% of the American public disapproved of him, figures from 538 show. In 2018, Republicans suffered a major defeat in the midterm elections and lost 40 seats in the House of Representatives, handing control of the House to the Democrats and allowing Nancy Pelosi to return as Speaker of the House. The midterm elections that year took place on 6th of November. By that point, Donald Trump's approval rating was 41.9% compared to disapproval level of 52.8%. However, the president's approval rating is only one factor in the midterm elections, and though it plays a role in voters' choices, other issues are likely to influence the outcome of the 2022 midterm elections, including high inflation, the state of the economy, and the recent landmark Supreme Court ruling on abortion. The prospects for Democrats look bleak in 538's generic congressional ballot, which shows Republicans enjoying 44.8% support to the Democrats' 42.7%, a narrow but potentially crucial lead of 2.1 percentage points. Republicans are likely to focus on issues such as the cost of living crisis in their midterm campaigns and take aim at Joe Biden's handling of the economy. The president's unpopularity could give Republican candidates a boost in close election races. In general, Democratic candidates across the country and up and down the ballot must grapple with a difficult national political environment, and one in which they could be dragged down by President Joe Biden's low approval rating and inflation taking a bite out of voters' bank accounts. American voters are reminded of inflation every time they go to the grocery store or every time they fill up their gas tanks. The president's party generally suffers losses in the midterm elections, with an average loss of 23 seats in midterm elections since 1974. The biggest single loss was under then-President Barack Obama in 2010, when the Democrats lost 63 seats in the House of Representatives. One strategy that Joe Biden has adopted ahead of the midterm elections is referring to pro-Trump Republicans as ultra-MAGA. Though this phrase was reportedly arrived at following polling and consultation, it has been embraced by Donald Trump and widely panned as bad messaging. It remains to be seen if the Supreme Court's abortion rulings in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey will have a major impact on the midterm elections. But the push to protect abortion rights could drive turnout among Democratic voters. But how about possible criminal charges against former President Donald Trump? The ongoing live hearings of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 could also play a role, as new information about attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election continues to be revealed. There is speculation that the Department of Justice could bring charges against former President Donald Trump, a move that would likely upend both political parties' midterm strategies. If Republicans can retake either chamber of Congress, they would effectively be able to stymie Joe Biden's agenda for the next 2 years, leading up to the next presidential election. While Donald Trump has repeatedly teased that he will run again in 2024.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss
has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth, to kill thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
To try to provide a different narrative against what is produced by the mainstream media is not an easy job. That's what Press TV has been trying to do all along. The coverage of issues like the Israeli regime's daily atrocities in the occupied Palestine, US war crimes in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the US-backed Saudi war in Yemen, and the very fact that the hypocrisy on the part of the so-called mainstream media has brought Press TV on the wrong side of many people.
I think Press TV had a huge amount of success, certainly in the early years. Of course, they've faced a lot of pushback. Of course, the Zio Western media controls satellites. It controls a lot of the media output. So in more recent years, of course, there's been a tacit campaign, a concerted campaign to try and stop Press TV being able to get as far as it could. YouTube have been involved. Many of the sat channels, which are run by Murdoch over here in the West, also turned on them. But nonetheless, there is a real substantial audience of Press TV, which is picking up those lives and then sharing it across social media.
Press TV has faced hardships and bans since the very first days of its launch. Perhaps the most notable of such bans was in June 2021, when the channel's web domain was seized by the United States. In fact, by shutting down Press TV, the US decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the US narrative. But why is it that a platform like Press TV faces so many restrictions? A recent poll by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism paints a grim picture for the mainstream media. Not only they are losing their viewership, but their viewers also trust them less.
Trust in news is also declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time.
Such news is not good news for the mainstream media, of course. People tend to turn to other sources of information that offer a different narrative, such as Press TV.
So the reality is that the Western media has played an absolutely diabolical role in terms of its kind of balanced reporting on West Asia as a whole. So not only Palestine, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that whole region, Western media has essentially been part of the terrorism that has been wrought on the entire region by Western imperialist military forces. The media in the West has really ridden shotgun and supplemented the psychological operations aspect of whatever they wanted to do in that region. What they want to do is obviously to subjugate the Yemenis, subjugate the Iraqis, subjugate everybody in that region to continue to maintain their hold on energy resources and various other geopolitical interests.
To get a glimpse of just how different Press TV is from other mainstream media, one can look at an open letter signed by more than 2,000 Canadian journalists last year about how biased their media is towards Israel.
Anyone who has worked in a Canadian newsroom has encountered the reluctance or resistance in covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Canadian style guides still ban the use of the word Palestine in their coverage.
After publishing the letter, some journalists even published another letter saying they fear retaliation over publicly discussing such matters. In a world where mainstream media even censors their own journalists for using the word Palestine, it is no wonder that a platform like Press TV has faced so many hurdles and bans.
The United States is drumming up support from regional nations in East and West Asia to unite under alliances against Washington's perceived threats. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the U.S. held secret meetings with senior Israeli and Arab military figures, namely from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in March. The talks were focused on Iran. Washington has been mulling the idea of forming a regional alliance against Tehran by bringing those with strained relations with Iran closer to Israel for quite some time now. The Abraham Accords, under which several Arab nations normalized their ties with Israel, is widely believed to have been part of the plan. This is while Iran is taking diplomatic steps to strengthen ties with its regional neighbors, which may include some of the very nations that are being considered by Washington as potential anti-Tehran allies. The Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia have been engaged in talks aimed at the normalization of their bilateral relations over the past few months. Iranian and Emirati officials have also expressed willingness to restore warmer ties in recent months.
What we can observe is the world as a whole is moving towards a more multipolar world where countries are not afraid to be in relationship with one another despite U.S. interests. And we see this happening all throughout the world, And we can simply look to a summit of the because that was a failed attempt at the U.S. to kind of bully itself into remaining and enforcing its U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world. And so with recent events that have been happening around the world, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the U.S. trying to, again, impose U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world, we see countries moving further and further away from U.S. interests and really focusing on building with one another in the interests, in the best interests of their own countries.
That poses some serious questions about the effectiveness of a potential U.S.-backed regional anti-Iran coalition. North Korea has accused the United States of trying to set up a NATO-style military alliance in Asia, saying Washington continues to hold military maneuvers with East Asian states despite Pyongyang's warnings. In a statement posted on its official website on Sunday, North Korea's foreign ministry said Washington is making a, quote, full-fledged move to establish an Asia-style NATO while blatantly holding joint military exercises with Japan and South Korea. The remarks come on the heels of recent joint exercises by the U.S., South Korean, and Japanese forces, which involved a U.S. aircraft carrier for the first time in more than 4 years. In a meeting after the drills, North Korean officials condemned aggressive moves by Washington and Seoul, pledging to take revenge on the U.S. imperialists as they mark the 72nd anniversary of the outbreak of the Korean War. Why is it that Washington prefers setting up military deterrence when it can resolve conflicts through diplomatic means? Wouldn't that be a less costly and more efficient way of diffusing tensions?
We live in a world where, with all the nuances of North Korea, with all the misinformation that we are told about North Korea, the U.S. is trying to create fear without actual evidence. So what we can expect in upcoming months is that the U.S. is going to try to make it seem as if North Korea is the aggressor, as if they are not doing military exercises right outside of North Korea's borders, to provoke and to create the conditions to justify military actions and military exercises against the people in North Korea that have chosen to continue to build their country in favor of a one Korea and reuniting their countries and moving away from U.S. Interests.
The history of U.S.-led alliances, including that of NATO, shows that more often than not, they fail to accomplish their self-declared objectives. It wouldn't come as a surprise if newer ones won't have a different fate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the National Audit Office has made it clear that it is concerned at how the British government still maintains that it will build 40 entirely new hospitals, when in reality many will merely be extensions or refurbishments of existing ones. We now present you an article written by Toby Helm under the heading Boris Johnson Faces Investigation into Claims of Over 40 New Hospitals. The British government's official spending watchdog is to launch an inquiry into Prime Minister Boris Johnson's claim that 40 new hospitals will be built by 2030, as concerns grow in Whitehall that the pledge is unaffordable and has been greatly oversold to the public. In a move that could prove hugely embarrassing for the Prime Minister, the Independent National Audit Office, the NAO, has decided to conduct a value-for-money review into the entire scheme, which was a cornerstone of the Conservative Party's 2019 general election manifesto. The National Audit Office has made clear that it is concerned at how the government still maintains that it will build 40 entirely new hospitals, when in reality many will merely be extensions or refurbishments of existing ones. In a letter to the Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who had raised questions about delays and the resulting rising costs of the scheme with their National Audit Office, its top official Gareth Davis, the Controller and Auditor General, said he was already preparing a full value-for-money review. Gareth Davis also said that he had taken particular note of the implications of delay for increasing costs at this time of high inflation and the matter of whether all projects truly meet the classification of new hospitals. Gareth Davis said he would be reporting back in 2023. The National Audit Office's intervention will raise further questions about honesty and standards inside the Johnson government, following the long-drawn-out Partygate controversy and a series of recent scandals involving male Conservative MPs. On Friday, 1st of July, Boris Johnson's former Deputy Chief Whip, Chris Pincher, was suspended from the party after he was accused of abusing two men at the Carlton Club in London. This was a week after their party had lost two by-elections, both triggered by scandals involving Conservative MPs who had to step down. Many Tories fear their party is now becoming more widely distrusted on policy, having broken pledges not to raise national insurance, abandoned the triple lock on pension increases last year, and scaled back high-speed rail projects in the north of England. The Conservatives promised to deliver 40 new hospitals in their 2019 manifesto, but it has since been revealed that many of these projects are just improvements to existing hospitals. Last year, it emerged that ministers had been instructing trusts to give an exaggerated impression to the public of the scale of the projects by referring to refurbishments as new hospitals. A guidance document distributed to trusts and entitled New Hospital Programme Communications